This is the Hinckley Radio Hour, a series of engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, when Sean Reyes was appointed by Governor Herbert late last December to take over the office of Attorney General after John Swallow resigned, Reyes inherited an office marred by months of legal investigations into unethical campaign contributions that Swallow received while campaigning for the office. That's why Reyes now seems to favor making the Attorney General seat an appointed position.
The argument goes, you will take away a lot of the external pressure from special interests, from businesses, which frankly were at the root of and at the heart of some of the Attorney General's office's recent travails, or at least the leadership there.
Restoring public trust in the Utah Attorney General's office. That's after this news. This is the Hinckley Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Late last year, on December 30th, Sean Reyes was appointed Attorney General by Governor Herbert. His appointment followed months of legal investigations of unethical and widespread abuse of public trust of the office by former Attorney General John Swallow. But Reyes is now running to keep his seat to fill the 2 years remaining on Swallow's term. This year, Reyes, a Republican, will face Democratic challenger Charles Stormont for the AG's position. Meanwhile, Sean Reyes is now responsible for leading the state of Utah's contentious appeal of a federal court's decision to allow same-sex marriage in Utah. Recently, Reyes also filed a petition on behalf of the Utah Department of Health and the Office of Vital Records and Statistics to halt child adoptions by LGBT parents that were set in motion after that contended federal court decision. But critics say the state's lawsuit led by Reyes adds insult to injury for parents who now face a costly and confusing legal gauntlet. In this hour, Reyes shares his thoughts on the AG's office and how trust might be restored and maintained in the future. He also gives some thoughts on the current Amendment 3 case and the legal question of same-sex marriage in Utah. This Hinckley Radio Hour was recorded live with an audience of students, faculty, and reporters at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah on April 18th, 2014.
I want you here in the audience to, again, for this role play, if you will, help me be part of my executive team right now. And I see other friends here sitting in the front. It's great to see so many friendly faces, and even unfriendly faces. Someone suggested that we have a tomato throwing portion of the presentation, and I'm open to that some other day. I'll bring a different attire, and we could do that if anything I say offends. Hopefully not, though. So you all have just been enlisted right now, been deputized. Your assistant. Special Assistant Attorney General for the Attorney General's Office. And our first issue is recognizing who we need to restore trust with. So I will take suggestions from you, my executive team. So, okay, team, what constituencies, who do we need to rebuild trust with? That's what we're going to, and let's focus externally, outside of our office first, because we're going to get there in a second. So don't be bashful and shy. The public generally, okay,
yes.
But let's break that. So we'll put down public, and when you have a second. Any more, public is good. That's
kind of broad.
That's a little broad. Let's narrow it down. Anybody else? I can throw things out.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to say this, but the delegates.
Delegates,
probably
sure.
Probably important if you want to get back in.
Well, on the political side, and that's a good point. You have an inherent tension between an office that has to make policy decisions and legal decisions and that has to get reelected. And we'll talk about that a little bit because I think that dynamic's an important one. It exists, and how you approach that will affect how much trust the public has or doesn't have in the office. Anybody else? Yes, sir. In the front row.
Okay, all right. How about the press?
Good, the press, the media. We have some fine members of the media here that that I see, both print media and television and radio. Anybody else? Keep going. Legal, who said that? Matt? That's why he was our superstar intern. Legal community, and when we say the legal community, let's even break that down more specifically. You have courts, the judges, and let me tell you, as you practice here in a smaller state like Utah, your reputation is all that you have. Now, I've practiced in other big states, and they don't care, because their philosophy is, we'll never see you again, so we can act any way we want. But here, by and large, whether we're on the other side of issues or cases, it's very collegial, and your reputation is very important, and any misstep there travels very quickly throughout the legal community. So courts, who else? Who else is in the legal community, sir? Okay, well, step out of the legal community and let's talk about the legislature. So the legislature you have to win trust with. Yes?
Law enforcement.
Good. Law enforcement community. I'm just going to keep ticking these off because you're getting all of these. So the legislature, I put that under the political community, and I also included, aside from state representatives, counties and cities. So the local ones, you have sheriffs, counties, county attorneys, commissioners, city mayors, their commissions, and then the federal delegation. You also have the federal component, and we have federal representatives from both parties as well. Going back to the legal community, it's maybe too obvious. You have lawyers, that your peers who you work with, on a daily basis. In our office, just to give you a little flavor of how big our office is, we have over 230 lawyers. They're spread out in offices throughout the state. We represent hundreds, and I guess if we counted commissions and committees, probably over 1,000 different state agencies, commissions, committees. And so the impact of the AG's office is felt probably on a daily basis, even though you may not realize it. Everything from licensing and health issues to business and family issues. Business community, I'm going to add that in. Some of the controversy with our office over the last few years has involved the business community, and it's vital in my view to restore trust with that demographic as well. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Election commission.
Okay, good. We have the Lieutenant Governor's office that handles most of the elections issues in the state, and certainly that's they're part of the executive branch. And so when we go back into government and we're talking about state reps, we're also talking about the executive branch. We mentioned the judiciary and the judicial branch before. Good. Anything else? Other agencies, when you talk about federal agencies, whether it's law enforcement, ICE, DEA, FBI, these are our partners on a daily basis. We have a case, which I can't talk about extremely publicly, I have to be careful about it, but we have apprehended an individual who is alleged to have human trafficked many victims into our state and allegedly has abused them and other citizens of our state to allegedly mule drugs into not just high schools, but junior high schools and potentially even elementary schools. So we deal with drug interdiction, human trafficking, and all sorts of the law enforcement issues with our law enforcement partners in the Attorney General's office. Local law enforcement would include, as I mentioned before, sheriffs and police chiefs and all of their important line officers. And at the state level, the Department of Public Safety, DPS, at the federal level, again, all of the federal agencies. So this is a pretty good representation. The last one I would put, although it's sort of internal and external, and it's, I think, probably the most important, is our clients. And we represent so many different state agencies, and they have to have trust in the attorneys. And so there's that. Missy, can you just draw a line and maybe change the color now? And let's talk about internally. Who do we have internally? Maybe Charles, you can help me out, because you know, being in the office, when I'm talking about internally, who are we dealing with?
Just a quick explanation here. Charles Stormont is the Democratic candidate challenging Reyes this year for the job of Attorney General. Stormont also works as an assistant attorney in the AG's office with Reyes, and he sat in the back of the room.
Mr. Stormont said, not just line attorneys like himself, secretaries, paralegals, investigators. This is our entire family in the Attorney General's office. And there's been a lot of distrust internally because of their perception of a lack of support in many ways, and that includes compensation, and that includes resources, that includes decisions made by management. So I think that's a pretty fair representation of the different constituencies, and I think the young lady said it best at the beginning, encompassing all of those is, I mean, you could just call that public trust. And here's the important part now, and I'll still ask you for your help. And we can walk through these things. I'm going to talk about maybe 9 or 10 things that we have tried to do and implement already policy-wise. Some of them I think we can effectuate more quickly. Others will be far more long-term. And then you can tell me what you think about these things. Tell me if you think that we're wrong. Tell me if you think that they're good ideas. And then also give me your ideas to help us. And one of the things I learned early on, even staffing large billion-dollar litigation teams, is, you know, listen even to the youngest attorney, because some of those ideas that are most important, they come from all different sources. So solutions, I'm going to talk about them. Maybe I'll have Missy write them up first. I'll address them briefly, and then we can come back in and talk substantively about them. One of the first issues you have is whether we appoint or elect an attorney general, okay? And we can come back to that in a second. The second issue would be, and this is something that that's a current issue, and this is why I bring it up, the effect of the caucus system on our public officials and restoring public trust, and whether our caucus system is the best system. Whether it can be refined, whether there's other systems that are better. Campaign finance, number 3. These are in no particular order. They were just, as I wrote them down, not prioritized. And under those, and we can again come back and talk about those, that includes transparency, and that includes who you take money from as a candidate or as a public servant. Caps on the amount of money. All of those things, I think, are very important discussions. Another one after that, I would just say, I call it separation of the business of the state, what the Attorney General is doing, representing the citizens of the state, and what the Attorney General has to do in order to run politically and campaign. And there should be a clear line of demarcation there. It's why I have 2 laptops. I've been speaking to this the entire time. I apologize. It's why I have 2 phones, because we want to make sure that the business of the state, that the people don't lose trust, that the Attorney General is campaigning all the time or using state resources for campaigns or vice versa. There needs to be a bright line, and that's why I have staff for both sides. We can get into that a little bit more. But again, that's the separation issue. There's also one about just being out and being out in all the counties. I don't know how many of you are here from Utah. I don't know if you were all just from the largest 4 counties or any of you are from rural counties. I grew up in the inner city in LA, moved out to the suburbs for junior high school and high school, but I spent almost all my summers in Hawaii on the Big Island with my grandparents, far away from the population centers. It was a cow town. If any of you have been, how many of you traveled to Hawaii? Any of you? How about the Big Island? Yeah, that's what I thought. Not too many of you. So a lot more rural, not as fancy, not as tourist friendly. And so I, growing up, really internalized what it was like to feel distance from the power structures and feel like your voice wasn't being heard. So I think it's an important part of the AG's office to make sure that I'm out amongst the different counties, listening to the issues that affect, again, not just the front, but everyone throughout the state.
You're listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW and a recorded talk by Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. Coming up, Reyes discusses proposals to make the state attorney general's office an appointed rather than elected position. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes spoke last week at the University of Utah on ways that he thinks trust can be restored to the Attorney General's office after the resignation last year of the former AG, John Swallow.
One is just, again, being frank and honest and consistent about policies, making policy decisions not for political expediency or and I say that not just from a campaign expediency, but even internally, things that would be popular internally, but you know you can't sustain. You have to make tough decisions for the betterment of the office long term, even though they may not be exciting for those in the short term who are in the office. But so again, making those tough decisions for long term stability. I'm going to put this one down just as consistency, and this is going to encompass the idea. I'm sure most of you are, if not all of you, are familiar with the Amendment 3 case that our office has been handling, defending the constitutional amendment to Utah state law, outlawing same-sex marriage, and then also the corollary laws in the statute that were passed by the legislature. And part of the debate about that, outside of the legal debate, is the notion of whether an attorney general should defend laws all the time, or whether there is leave for the attorney general to exercise discretion in not defending laws. And that's something we can get back and talk to in a few minutes. I just want to outline all these things. Finally, and I don't know how many this is, but in my experience, nothing wins trust back from the people who work with lawyers than just doing excellent legal work. And my hope is that top to bottom, our law firm will be the best law firm or one of the best law firms. Right now, I think we have a number of tremendously talented lawyers, but part of our problem is the pay discrepancy. We've lost so many lawyers who are going to small counties because they can get paid $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 more than what we can offer, and that's difficult. It's difficult when you spend a lot of resources to train up a lot of talented young lawyers and then they leave. So finding incentives to keep them, because that's the only way we'll be able to be consistently suppliers of excellent legal work. So again, these are some of the solutions that we have as an executive team and that I've made part of my vision to win back the trust of the Attorney General's office. And we can talk about them now with the time remaining, or answer specific questions that you have, because I want to make sure I leave time to let you ask questions. Appoint or elect. There was a bill run by the Senate this year, or was run by a senator, to have the discussion about possibly making the Attorney General a permanently appointed position. And just for fun, right now, straw poll, and I'll announce the results so our radio audience can hear it too. Just by a show of hands, whether you've thought about it or not, how many of you think it's a better idea to have the Attorney General appointed permanently, like the federal model, our United States Attorney General is appointed by the President, or to have the Attorney General elected by popular vote from the people? So appointment, how many of you, raise your hands. There's no right or wrong answer, just your opinion. One in the back, two, okay. And elected, raise your hand. Wow, that's a pretty overwhelming majority for, it was probably, 40 to 2. Let me give you some quick arguments on both sides, and then we can, I won't say which state specifically that I've practiced in, but when they elect judges instead of appointing judges in those states, I've found that's not necessarily the best judiciary that we can find. I joke and quip and say they've got great teeth and they're very attractive, but not the best and the brightest. And that's one of the perils of allowing the Attorney General to just be elected, is maybe you're not getting the highest quality. And many people say that because of the election process and the amount of money that it costs and the amount of scrutiny, the amount of pain that it might inflict on your family, I went through a pretty painful election cycle the last time on the Republican side, and a lot of things that were said about me that I knew weren't true and my family knew weren't true, and the public didn't know that until more recent events brought those to light. And so those who argue for appointment say the best of the best aren't running for the office of Attorney General. Maybe it would be better if we vested that power with the governor or the legislature or even the Supreme Court. 7 states appoint in the United States. And one of them is by the Supreme Court. I think two, or one by the legislature and the rest by the governor. So you can see that there's some valid argument to be made for appointment, that maybe letting the governor vet candidates, like we do with judges in our state. I used to sit on the Judicial Nominating Commission, and we would go through 100 applicants and narrow it down essentially to three names and send those up to the governor. And we were lawyers and citizens and judges, and we felt like we would be able to help vet the best of the best and funnel them up to the governor and make the appointment. Anybody biting, want to change their vote on to appointment yet? I'm trying to make some compelling arguments. I got one taker at least. And then, of course, probably for those who want to, the proponents of appointment, their biggest emphasis is on the issue of campaign finance and donations. And if the person's appointed, the argument goes, you will take away a lot of the external pressure from special interests, from businesses, which frankly were at the root of and at the heart of some of the Attorney General's office's recent travails, or at least the leadership there. So anybody else, do you think that's a pretty compelling argument? You take away the big money that goes into these races and that kind of pressure, and then you don't have that influence on the Attorney General, who's making critical legal decisions that affect everyone in the state. Well, those are the arguments on the side of appointment. On the side of election, and since I'm preaching to the proverbial choir here with all of your votes, I'll try to be brief, and that is the strongest arguments there are, we need the Attorney General accountable directly to the people. We need the Attorney General to be an independent voice, even against the legislature and the executive branch, even at times against the governor. Although the Attorney General ideally would work well with all of those, you need that tension in order to have to yield the best results ultimately, because those are the checks and balances, at least horizontally, that we desire to have. By shifting the pressure from the Attorney General over to the person who appoints, all you're doing is shifting the influence and the big money. Maybe they're not going to be contributing to the Attorney General, but they might be contributing to the governor or the legislature to try to put that pressure on them to appoint somebody that the contributors want. And so there are countervailing arguments to all of these things. But personally, as a supporter of electing the Attorney General, I think I've got a list of 20 other points, but I won't go through them. I think ultimately you need to have the Attorney General accountable most directly to you all, the electorate and the people. And if the Attorney General's not doing a good job, then you have the ability to directly influence whether that person, he or she, stays or goes. Caucus system, that's another interesting subject that's right now at the heart and the front of the political debate. Senate Bill 54, which incorporates sort of a hybrid of keeping our current caucus system but allowing an alternate path closer to a direct primary. And I know Kirk probably knows this subject matter even better than I, but looking at that and saying, does the caucus system, again, vest too much power in a small group of delegates? Or on the other side, are those delegates the ones who will put the time and effort in vetting the candidates to represent their community's best interests and be the most informed voters? And so there's that tension right now going on. And I think that has an impact on how the Attorney General selected. But those are a little bit more peripheral. Campaign finance, and I'll talk about those directly. I think it's vital to have some, if not official reforms that the legislature passes. We've self-imposed our own campaign restrictions, and we'll roll all that out as we become the official nominee, as I do, of the Republican Party. So we haven't done it officially yet, but it includes more transparency, immediately reporting things so that the whole public can see the source of where campaign contributions are coming from, putting limitations on who you receive contributions from. I've already told several industries and individual entities, companies, and individuals, too, who wanted to contribute to the campaign, no, not because I don't think you're good folks or that you have, it's not a judgment against you, but even the potential perception of a conflict, to me, is something I want to avoid at this point. And so I think that if not, again, officially, we ought to have candidates trying their best to minimize, again, if not legitimate conflicts, even the appearance of potential conflicts, particularly in the Attorney General's office. I think it's important for all offices, but when you have somebody who regulates and oversees businesses and people's lives and families, I think it's critical that you have less political pressure from there. We didn't put it down, but I think at times the Attorney General's office can become too partisan, and I think it's been that way historically. I won't say how long in history, but over the last few years. And my view is that the Attorney General is much like many other public servants, a firefighter. If your house is on fire, what do you want that firefighter? Let me ask you, anybody, do you care what political stripe that firefighter is at the time that they're trying to put out your fire at your home or save or evacuate you and your family? Anybody? I view the AG's office like that largely. There are certain issues that I think people will perceive to be politically motivated. And certainly, I don't think any public servant can totally divorce themselves from whatever sort of experience and background and moorings that they have, whether those, however they're personally informed. I think it would be disingenuous to say that doesn't somehow affect decisions that they make. But by and large, for our office, we try to view things only through the prism and the lens of what is legal, what is the law, what is our responsibility and duty to the law, not how many votes will this get, can we stick it to a particular political party. And I think to the extent that the Attorney General's office can be less partisan, it'll go a long way to winning back public trust. Does anybody want to disagree with that proposition or comment on it? I know I said I'd have questions, and I'm just now blathering on. Sir?
My name is Brian Smith. I guess just quickly while you're on it, you're a proponent of the election system, but advocating for less partisan office. How do you see those two corresponding, and how can we make the election of the Attorney General less partisan when inherently a partisan election is very partisan?
So your question is, I think I understand it. You can't divorce entirely politics from the Attorney General's office. It's surrounded by it at the legislature as part of the political process. I am a supporter of the political process, and I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. I think you can have, and Charles and I'm very pleased, again, that Charles is my opponent, and we have other fine opponents too, Andrew McCullough and other people who've entered the race. But I know Charles to be an upstanding individual. I think you can have healthy dialogue, discussion, debate, and again, that yields the best results ultimately for the end user when you have a competition of ideas, just like it does in the free market when you have a competition of products and services. At the same time, when you're in that office and when you've become elected to that office, you have to understand that you're not beholden to a political party. You're beholden to the law. And I think that's one of the reasons I like the Attorney General's office, is because we have a pretty narrow focus, and it is what is the law, and how do we enforce that law in a rational, reasonable way. We don't make policy. We can influence it, particularly up at the legislature. They ask for our opinion on many bills, and we try to make sure that they have the right constitutional moorings and that they do what they're intended to do. But so I definitely don't see those things as being contradictory. However, I can acknowledge that there's some tension there, and that in order to get elected, you appeal to a particular demographic. But I've been very upfront with delegates from my party that it's not my job to be the activist general, or it's not my job to be the pastor general or anything else. I don't represent necessarily their personal or political views in terms of the law. I represent, as an officer of the court, my ethical duties to the law. And to as much as you can hew to those guidelines, I think the public is best served. So let's jump to that issue then, because I think maybe I'm anticipating, but maybe people will want to talk about that. Warren Buffett has a great quote. Let me take a sidestep. And he talks about a personal scorecard. And the notion is that regardless of what the public thinks or what anybody else thinks, if you're true to yourself and you're true to what you think is the right thing, then you need to be consistent and stay with that.
You're listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW. Coming up, Utah's current Attorney General Sean Reyes gives his views on the Amendment 3 case involving same-sex marriage that he is litigating on behalf of the state of Utah. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Utah State Attorney General Sean Reyes gave a talk last week on restoring trust in the Attorney General's office. Reyes was appointed to the position at the end of last year after former Attorney General John Swallow resigned after months of investigation into ethical and widespread abuse of public trust of his office. Reyes has only been in the position for a few months now, but he is facing an election this year to keep his seat. His Democratic challenger, Charles Stormont, an assistant attorney who also works in the AG's office, attended Reyes's talk but did not speak. Reyes is now leading the state of Utah's appeal of the federal court decision to strike down Amendment 3, the law that bans same-sex marriage in Utah. He's also leading legal efforts to stop adoptions of children by LGBT parents in Utah that are already in motion since the federal court decision. Reyes spoke last Friday on April 19th, 2014.
My view of the Attorney General's role, again, is to support, obey, and defend all of the laws of the state of Utah, whether I agree with those laws or disagree with those laws. Without that, my fear is that if an Attorney General has the discretion to pick and choose which laws to defend or not defend, while perhaps politically convenient in the short term, going back to that theme, maybe it would win points with one party or another, maybe it would make the Attorney General more popular, more electable. In the long run, it undermines confidence in the office because people need to have to, the public needs to know that the rule of law ultimately will govern and that there are processes. If you're unhappy with the law, you can elect new lawmakers or put enough pressure on those lawmakers that they can change the law. If you're unhappy with the constitutional amendment, you can, through the process of voting, change that and have it influenced that way. Or you can challenge it legally. And in that process of challenging it legally, what I love about our American system is that we afford both sides a vigorous defense. And much like people would not expect a public defender, whether they agree with the actions of the person they're defending or not, they would not expect the public defender to just stand aside and say, you know what? I'm not excited about this case, don't like this person, I'm not going to give them a defense. I think most people would say, that's not right, that person needs a defense. However you feel about any given law that the state has passed, once it's been challenged, there's a role, and the Attorney General's specific role is to defend those laws, whether you agree with them or not. And again, I think people can try to use for political gain and rationalize that away. But I think it's an extremely dangerous precedent. Unless there is clear Supreme Court guidance, or in our case, perhaps Tenth Circuit, so the circuit, unless there is a precedential law that specifically says, for instance, that the law that you're trying to defend is unconstitutional, not just that you believe it's unconstitutional, or a lot of people believe it's unconstitutional, or some other judges might think it's unconstitutional, unless there is binding precedent that says this law is unconstitutional, it deserves a vigorous defense just like any individual would in our legal process. And so when I talk about, and people have been very, the media has been anxious to hear my personal views on the Amendment 3 case and where I stand, and I've been very quiet about those, not because I don't have them, not because I don't feel passionately about it, but I think it distracts from the extremely important role of the Attorney General in defending the laws of the state. One, I don't want the court focused on my personal views, and two, I don't want the people focused on that, because that's not what's motivating me. Interesting tidbit, we're not very public about it, and I guess I am now, and Missy is probably giving me the careful sign. But we have people who are on the Amendment 3 issue, who are very passionately lawyers, proponents of both sides, so very strongly opinionated lawyers, yet we are all united in the defense of our state's laws. And those who oppose the law personally in our office are still doing their duty and responsibility by putting up a vigorous defense. And so I think it's unfair, not just to me, but to those who are working with me, to criticize them for defending the laws when that is precisely the role of the Attorney General in the whole process. So very long answer to your question, but yes, here in the front.
Sean, I had a quick question. The balance for appointment is kind of a negative. If you have governors of perhaps who are integrity challenged or even intellectually challenged, it sets a very dangerous precedent because the Attorney General's office is the only one that can investigate purported irregularities in the governor's office. With the election, you're absolutely right about responsibility to the electorate, to the people, not just who voted for you, but to the people of the state, whichever state you may be in. I didn't know if that helped your position or not.
Well, you know, I think one of the strongest arguments, just to repeat mm-hmm. what you said, is if you vest so much power in any one body and the Attorney General becomes just an appendage of
a
that,
functionary.
An extension of that. When you have a good governor or a good legislature, then maybe the results are positive. You may not always have those situations, and I think having an appointed Attorney General only exacerbates that because there's no check. I think that was what I was
right.
talking about.
Right, and you don't want to have an Attorney General that they say the best place to put to hide something from him is to put it in a law book.
Right. I've got lots of lawyer jokes. I can share some of them with you afterwards. Separation of business and political, I don't know if anybody, that seems very intuitive to me. I can't imagine anybody's really going to argue with. It makes a lot of sense to have if you're going to be political, which again, I still think it's an important part of the process to make sure that the Attorney General, for all the reasons I articulated, is accountable to the people. But there are some dangers of a political process. Let's make it as separate as possible from the actual functions of the Attorney General's office. So you never see my political team up at the Capitol. And vice versa, you don't see my policy team at fundraisers and that. My view is that if I do a terrific job being Attorney General, if I really strive hard to be balanced, measured, be an honest broker, apply the law the best way that I see, that the people will, that is the best campaign message that I can give. And so I have spent only the last few days going out to county conventions to make sure that I live up to the commitment to be out and hear the voices of all Utahns. But I spent in the last 90-plus days, I'd say 2-5% of my time on actually campaigning. And that was my own personal time because I've put in 90-100 hours a week on the business of the state. And I think that that's, critical. Again, I want the standard to be so high in the Attorney General's office. Not that it hasn't been high, but I want to raise it up so that people who aren't willing to work extremely hard and who aren't extremely dedicated public servants, that it's uncomfortable for them and maybe they can self-select them. Part of the problems that we deal with, we have a Career Service Protection Act. So you can't just get rid of people who aren't performing well. You have to document for a long time, a year or more, and we haven't been doing that. And so we have people who aren't pulling their weight, and it's frustrating, and it lowers morale, and it drags on the people who are killing themselves because they're already making less than their private sector counterparts. I view so many of the attorneys in my office as true public servants because they're not there for the money. I guarantee you that. I've now seen that firsthand, what that's like, and I'm telling you, it's not for the money because it's not there. It's not for the glory because you don't hear about assistant attorneys general on the front pages of the Bar Journal, but it's because they're dedicated servants and they really do want to make a difference in people's lives. And that's the people that I'm looking for and that I want to cultivate and equip with the right resources and the right amount of money. When I walked into the legislature this year, they said, Sean, you'll be lucky to get a couple of pennies because we just spent four, not all of them, and I won't say which legislator said that to me, but We just spent $4 million on your office, so don't expect much, if anything. I think because of the trust that we built with them over the 45 days, how hard they saw us working, how dedicated they believed that we are to getting the right result, not a partisan result, how committed we are to trying to do the right thing, to be transparent and restore honor and integrity to the office, that they rewarded our office with a very healthy compensation bump because, frankly, many of our support staff hadn't had a raise in 6 or 7 years. And prior to that, it was percentages. Those things are critical for me to make sure that the hardworking public servants in the AG's office get what they need to get the, you know, they're working under extremely difficult circumstances. I'll throw one thing out just so you can get a flavor of how hard of a job it is for us. And I realize, and I hope I'm not opening our office to any liability issues, but the ABA, the American Bar Association recommendation for a child protection lawyer, those lawyers who deal with the tough issues about child abuse and placement and displacement from the home, work with the guardian ad litems, their recommendation is that no lawyer carry more than 60 cases. Our average caseload for those lawyers is over 120 cases, so double. And in certain counties, up until last year when the legislature gave us an appropriation, they were carrying 180 cases. They didn't choose that. The money's just not there. We can't magically create more positions, and they're trying their best. But those are the circumstances that many of our lawyers in the AG's office are working under. They're representing 100 different agencies when they should have maybe one or two that they can focus on. And so it's going to be a difficult long-term process for me to help build up and get all the resources that we need to elevate it to become truly one of the preeminent law firms. But I'm committed to doing that. You've had your hand a really long time in the back. I'm sorry for not recognizing you earlier.
I just had a question about your first page on the constituencies.
Sure.
That you had. An oftentimes forgotten constituent in the state of Utah is Indian tribes, and I know your office enters into MOUs, memorandums of understandings, intergovernment agreements, and oftentimes are sued over jurisdictional issues. And my question is, what's your plan to restore and cultivate those relationships?
You know, we've already
the seven
did. Everybody
tribes?
Hear the question about Indian lands and our Native American tribes, because they are absolutely a vital part of our constituency and the public dialogue. And you may know my brother Kyle, who's very involved in those issues. I have already, and our team has already been trying to work on some of those, renewal of some of those MOUs. Just to paint the picture for you, when you're talking about federal jurisdiction, county jurisdiction, and Indian land jurisdiction, I likened it to the Middle East, and I'm not making any comparisons about or judgments. I'm just talking about the dynamic. I think you all know colloquially, when you say trying to create peace in the Middle East, there's a detente there that is so difficult because people have valid claims on both sides, and people much wiser than me have for years and generations been trying to find that equilibrium. Well, that exists already just between the federal government and the counties in the state. And you talk about the Indian tribes who may have the best and strongest claim that surpasses any that the counties and the federal government have. Layered on top of that, and you really have a triumvirate of competing interests that make those situations so much more difficult to find that right solution that's fair and that honors the history and tradition and rights of not only the tribes, but of the federal government and the counties. And so I know I'm only stating the obvious because you're obviously familiar with that. We recognize that it's like a Gordian knot, and there's no simple solution. Otherwise, somebody would have figured it out a long time ago. You also, what doesn't hurt or help, for instance, in the some of the Indian lands, they've had differing decisions by the Tenth Circuit and federal courts that have only complicated and exacerbated the tensions. On the law enforcement side, we've tried to make sure that federal, state, and Indian law enforcement are all on the same page, and that at the very least, we don't have public safety issues and concerns. But we're still working through, and I have calls every day from county commissioners, from federal officials, and from representatives of the tribes concerned that they're being left out of the process. And my commitment was that to the extent that I can facilitate, I will make sure that all the voices are considered. Ultimately, I don't get to make the decisions on some of those issues, and I think litigation is probably the poorest solution, but you also have some on all of those sides who are invested in high-stakes litigation. And when I was a small claims judge, I would always try to have the litigants go out on the side and come up with a compromise and a settlement. Because I said, look, I'm happy to rule for one of you, but the other one's going to be extremely disappointed. If you can go out and find a win-win, or maybe a, you know, not as big of a win, but some kind of compromise, I think it's better. And so that's been my message to those parties, is that we can litigate, but I don't want to. I think it's a waste of the state's resources if we can avoid that. But we have to give respect and acknowledge all of the voices. And I know that sometimes certain of the people at the table feel like they don't have a big enough voice. In the front, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Reyes. This has been very enlightening. My question for you, I want to go back to this idea, if I can, of, you know, having discretion with which laws you choose to enforce and prosecute. And I understand and respect you saying you want to prosecute and enforce all the laws equally. That's a very fine sentiment, sir. But at the same time, I also heard you say that, you know, you have people, what is it, I think you said a minute ago, working with 100 government agencies that should only be working with 2. So it seems like you have very limited, scarce resources. So my question for you is, when you have to prioritize which laws to enforce, which people to prosecute, how do you choose which ones have a higher priority? Because, I mean, it seems like the reality is you can't always enforce everything equally.
No, I think that's a fair question. You can't always enforce everything equally, and I rely largely on my chief deputies, the division chiefs and the section chiefs, because they're much closer to the ground, much closer to the issues. And I believe that that's good government, too, that government always works best closest to the people. And they're the ones that give me recommendations. So I think I'll dispel any notion that I am so wise and omniscient and omnipotent that I could have a handle on, 10,000 different issues that are addressing our office on a, you know, daily or monthly basis. And so you do have to. And my management philosophy is empowering those people, putting people in that I think, regardless, again, of political background, of personal beliefs, putting the best, most qualified, not just lawyers, but managers in, who I trust, will help me make those hard decisions. And many of the decisions that I make are based on recommendations that come from people who say, you know what, we need to prioritize this. This case is needs more resources right now because the potential harm to victims is greater. I think it would be, again, a falsehood to think that you can put the exact amount of resources on every single legal issue. And so it's a wise question. And how do I go about prioritizing those? It depends on the situation. I know that sounds like a very lawyerly answer, but in the vacuum, I can't tell you that your case or somebody else's case is more important or less important. I will say this: I know that I have dedicated, again, public servants battling hard on the front lines every day, and my goal is to help all of them. But we prioritized getting another lawyer for child protection to take it down from 180 cases to 120 in those particular counties because then we waited for one more year to get another criminal appeals lawyer, even though, that chief needed one for the last 10 years. But slowly and little by little, if we start to put the law first and the interests of the people first instead of political ambitions, it'll take a while. Because it took a while to get where we are right now. It'll take a while to get all the way back to where we need to be. And this law office, the Attorney General's office, has been historically and at times a very proud law office, and I want to bring that that luster back. 2 minutes left. Any final questions, ma'am, here in the second row?
I'd like to ask a follow-up question to the last question that was just asked, and also thank you for being here. This has been really great. I'm curious if kind of a bright line you're using is harm to people for enforcing laws. I wonder kind of what what specifically you're doing in your office, and you know, when you're, if you're using that type of bright line, how you're kind of enforcing that and how you're deciding that that's the tool to use.
And let me be clear, that's a consideration. I gave the impression that that was the only mechanism or the bright line, it is not. I think I was referencing maybe one of my section chiefs or division chiefs saying, you know what, we're prioritizing these things this way because amongst many other considerations, perhaps there's more harm that's going to happen. We need a TRO on this case because if not, harm could occur. There are funds that victims of this Ponzi scheme that may disappear tomorrow unless we file something today. Is that an important consideration? Absolutely. Is it the sole consideration? No way. There are all sorts of other things that go into, I mean, resources for the attorneys themselves. Do we have the right attorney to prosecute that case? Do we need to do more investigation? Is it in the best interest of the child? Are we properly considering the parents' rights in this and the family? And there's so much weighing and balancing that goes in. It would be, I think, irresponsible to say that we have a bright line test and that it's harm to the people. But I do want to emphasize that that is a strong consideration. Thank you. Time's up. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Thanks for you're now, I'll relieve you of your duties so that there are no conflicts of interest. You can go back to all your regular jobs and no one will raise that on the campaign trail. You're no longer Deputy Assistant Attorneys General, but I appreciated your time today. Thanks so much and have a great day.
You've been listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour and a talk by current Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes, who spoke last Friday. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website. And join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. to hear more engaging forums and speakers on political and legal issues affecting Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.